All right.
Okay.
75 pages.
You want to start first?
Okay.
Wait. Yeah, okay.
The House Transportation Committee is coming to order.
And the House Committee on Revenue will come to order. Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate having a joint meeting with you today and to deal with these very, very important issues. And I think we'll let our committee administrator introduce them, if that's appropriate.
Yes.
Introduce
the agenda.
The agenda.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair and Ms. Chair. We have three items that we're going to hear about today. The first will be receipt of the highway cost allocation study, followed up by a presentation of the flat fee study, and we'll top off the meeting with a brief hit on the transportation revenue forecast. I think Mazin's going to give us a start off here.
And the state economist.
Yes.
We thought you'd be busy working on the next forecast, which you're going to deliver in 10 days.
Mr. Chair, I should be.
Thank you.
Well, we thank you for coming today.
Chair Baya and Chair Barnhart, you wouldn't think he would miss this for the state forecast, would you?
Absolutely not.
Yes. For the record, Mazin Malik with Legislative Revenue Office, I had to just quickly, Chair Byer and Chair Barnhart and members of the both committees, Transportation and Revenue, bring to your attention that what we're today about to receive with the highway cost allocation, that I've included a two-page with your packet. It's about the where the Oregon Constitution comes and mandates this study and commits it to your committees in order to be able to go with the constitutional mandate of reviewing and, if necessary, adjusting revenue sources to ensure fairness and proportionality. This is the constitutional Article 9, Section 3A. And in doing so, after you receive the study, the primary question, policy question for you would be whether those two sections of users, light and heavy vehicles, are paying their fair share proportionally in a sense that they are doing it in a big group rather than per subclass. And also the other phase of the paper talks about the highway cost allocation as it is in law. This is ORS 366506, where it talks about the highway cost allocation and basically puts it in the in DAS or in the state economist office, and that's why we have Tom Petersky, the state economist, here for us, and it also mandates by law that we have the legislative revenue committees, that means both House and Senate, and the transportation committees, House and Senate, to receive this discussion. Today, there's the joint transportation and revenue committees, and tomorrow we have the Senate joint transportation and revenue committees that will receive the same reports that you have today. And that's all I need to introduce, and here state economist Tom Petersky to update you. And he is the one who was overseeing the study, chaired the study review team, and chaired the whole process, and he did a great, admirable job on your behalf, because this is something that you would end up taking the policy decisions on.
Okay. Thank you, Mazin. Good afternoon. Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, members of the House Transportation Committee, members of the House Revenue Committee, for the record, my name is Tom Petowski with the Office of Economic Analysis, acting as representative for the Department of Administrative Services. Just as Mazin said, the Office of Economic Analysis oversees this study. We make assurances that the study is conducted in a scientific manner, Stakeholders have opportunities for input during the study process, and that the study findings are both transparent and reproducible for policy analysis, as Mazen has mentioned. In a response to requests for proposals from my office, we hired EcoNorthwest as the main consultant to conduct the highway cost allocation study. Later with me today will be Carl Batten from EcoNorthwest, who is the principal investigator on this study. Also today with me is Brian Hedman from the Cadmus Group. He served as our project manager. Brian coordinated all the meetings of our study review team. He held the consultant's feet to the fire to make sure deadlines were met, and has kept logs of all meetings, minute meetings that we undertook. Just want to add, you know, this is definitely a collaborative effort. Yes, we have the consultant for EcoNorthwest and Cadmus, but also ODOT plays a very important role in providing information and input into this process, as well as the study review team. And what I'd like to have come up, just to give you a sense of what this study review team does and sort of the accomplishments we had, one of the members is with us today, Don Negre from Willamette University, an economics professor there. And by the way, we have a number of members from that study review team are in the back of the room if you have further questions for them. So if Don could come up.
Good afternoon. My name is Don Negri. I'm a professor of economics across the street at Willamette University. Feeling a little old as I see one of my students up here on the in front of me. I was a member of the Oregon Highway Cost Allocation Study Review Team. That would be the OHCAS-SRT, if you're interested. I have a short list of the activities and the contributions that the study review team made to the allocation study. We evaluated the proposal. We determined the issue papers involved. We discussed and approved the allocators, especially when there was ambiguity in how those allocators should be determined. We discussed and evaluated model assumptions. We asked the contractor to trace down what appeared to be anomalies in the results if we questioned whether they made sense. We asked the contractor to provide detail and clarity, transparency in the report, and particularly in the model itself, making it also user-friendly to the Department of Transportation. We reviewed drafts of the report. We asked the contractor to provide a model that was easily understood, could be worked by a non-expert, and to ensure that it could be used for policy analysis. One of the contributions I think was most important by the study review team is that we were very future-oriented in terms of the issue papers. We asked the contractor to look at the impact of climate change policy on future financing of roads. We asked about the incorporation of environmental costs into the finances of roads, for example, pollution and noise. We were looking at ways in which we could improve the efficiency of our road system by using a different pricing system. All of these things will be possible in the future, and in my view, Oregon will be prepared when the time comes for a different method of financing roads. And finally, the bottom line is that the study review team contributed to making a better product, a product which is more user-friendly, policy relevant, and more transparent. Final point, these were all volunteers and did not cost the state anything other than the opportunity cost of the time of the people who are paid by the state to be there. So that's my statement, and if anybody would like to ask questions, I'm happy to answer them.
Questions? Let me simply say to you and to the other members of the team that the state of Oregon depends on citizen volunteers who are experts in various areas to be helpful to us as we do our work. And we really, really appreciate the time and the effort that you and people in your situation give to us.
Pleasure.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Reed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to add my thanks and welcome and note that I think it's very much in keeping with the motto of my alma mater across the street, not unto ourselves alone are we born. Thanks, Professor Negri.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you, Don. With that, I'd like to have Carl Batten of Eco Northwest come up to the table.
Thank you, Chair Beyer, Chair Barnhart, and members of the committees. I'm Carl Batten from Eco Northwest, and I'm here to present the results of the Oregon Highway Cost Allocation Study. Highway cost allocation is something that Oregon's been thinking about for a long time. The first study was conducted in 1937. I wasn't involved in that one. And there have been 16 studies so far. Since 1999, the state constitution has required a study every 2 years, and if that study finds the shares of revenues and costs to be out of balance between light and heavy vehicles, then it also requires the adjustment of revenue sources. So the question that we're answering for the purposes of the constitutional requirement is, are the shares of revenues paid by light and heavy vehicles fair and proportionate to their share of costs? The study is administered by the Department of Administrative Services, Office of Economic Analysis, led by Tom Petowski, and they contract for the study and oversee it. This time around, the study was conducted by Eco Northwest as the prime contractor, along with HDR Engineering, Mark Ford, Jack Fawcett Associates, and Roger Mingo. HDR Engineering provided expertise on Mark Ford provided expertise on financial issues. Jack Fawcett Associates provided expertise on some of the issue paper topics, including the cap and trade and carbon taxes. And Roger Mingo is our expert on pavements. Brian Hedman of the Cadmus Group served as the project manager, and ODOT staff provided data and technical assistance. The study review team, as Don Negri described, reviews the methods, data, results, and discusses the issues. There were a total of 11 people who served on the study review team through this study. Doug Anderson from Metro, Doug Benson from the Idaho Department of Transportation, Mazen Malik, Mike MacArthur, and John Oschel from the Association of Oregon Counties, Chris Monsier from Portland State University, Timothy Morgan from AAA Oregon, Don Negri, Tom Petowski, Bob Russell from the Oregon Trucking Associations, and Lorna Youngs from the Oregon Department of Transportation. So the question that highway cost allocation asks is, do various classes of highway users pay user fees in proportion to the costs they impose on the system? To answer that question, we need to define the user classes, allocate costs out to those classes, attribute revenues to those classes, and then calculate equity ratios. So once we've allocated all the costs of the highway system to the various user groups, we can calculate a share of the total cost for each of those user groups. Do the same thing for the revenues, and then we can calculate a ratio of those two ratios. So it's the share of revenue divided by the share of cost for each user group that is what we call their equity ratio. And when that ratio is near 1.0, we say they're paying their fair share. If it's more than 1.0, they're paying more than their fair share. And if it's less, they're paying less than their fair share. In Oregon, in particular, the cost to allocate are the expenditures over the upcoming biennium. So we look at the actual amount of money spent rather than a more theoretical concept of the costs imposed. The expenditures of federal funds are included because they are interchangeable with the expenditure of state funds, and the size of the total expenditures washes out because we're looking at ratios. So it's each user class's share of expenditures, and so it doesn't matter that the expenditures are larger than the revenues for the purpose of calculating equity ratios. The expenditures by local governments of state funds are included. They get a share of the state highway fund revenues and spend them. We count their expenditures as well. We count the expenditures by local governments of federal funds and some of their own source funds. The funds that they raise themselves that we count are the ones that are interchangeable with the state and federal funds. So if they have a bond levy for a particular project, we don't count the expenditures on that project as part of this, and we don't try to attribute the repayment of the bond revenues through property taxes to any particular class of highway users. So those get set aside. The other funds, if they have a local gas tax, if they spend general fund money, so on, those do get included. And Chapter 2 of the report describes the structure of the Oregon study in more detail. Since the Oregon Transportation Investment Acts, bond financing has played an important role in the financing of Oregon's highway system. And so we have to deal with the expenditures of revenues that come from the sale of bonds, and those bonds will be paid off over a period of time that extends beyond the time period of the current study. The way we handle that is we do include the expenditure of bond money, but we reduce the dollar amount of that expenditure to the share that will be paid off within the upcoming biennium. And then we carry forward those same expenditures into the next 9 studies to cover the 20-year repayment period. And it's about 16% of the total expenditures that are allocated in each of those 10 studies. The difference between 16% and 10% being the cost of the interest. A better description of that can be found in Chapter 3 of the report, and this is a little picture showing how the expenditure amount gets divided out into the 10 biennia over which it will be repaid. One of those goes, in the case of the first OTIF bond issue that went into the 2003 study, and then for the next biennium, more bond revenue was expended. It got divided out into 10 biennia, and the first of those went into the 2005 study, as well as the allocated results from the 2003 study. So now in the 2009 study, we've got bonded expenditures allocated in the 2003 study, the 2005 study, the 2007 study, and the 2009 study, all being included in the current study. In Oregon, bridge costs use the incremental approach, where we look at the cost of building a bridge that will carry the basic vehicles, and the cost of that bridge is allocated among all vehicles. Then we look at how much more expensive it would be to build a bridge that will carry 50,000-pound vehicles, and the cost of that bridge is allocated to all vehicles 50,000 pounds and over. Then we look at the cost of building a bridge that will carry 80,000-pound vehicles. How much more will that cost than the 50,000-pound bridge? That increment is then allocated to all vehicles 80,000 pounds and over. and so on. For pavement costs, we use the National Pavement Cost Model, which was developed for the Federal Highway Administration by Roger Mingo and adapted to Oregon for the purposes of this study. It's updated with each study with new information on the nature of the roads in Oregon and on the vehicle miles traveled by classification of road and weight of the vehicles. There's a complete list of allocators in Chapter 3, and Issue Paper 5 addresses the choice of allocators in this study. And then the Oregon study also specifically addresses alternative fee-paying vehicles. These are vehicles that pay something other than the normal set of fees that a vehicle would be expected to pay. For those vehicles, we calculate a subsidy amount, which isn't always really a subsidy. In some cases, they're paying more than they would if they were paying normal fees. But it's the difference between what they do pay and what they would pay if they paid the regular fees. And we do that for every weight class. We add it up, and then we take that total subsidy amount and allocate it out to all full fee-paying vehicles in each weight class in proportion to the vehicle miles traveled by full fee-paying vehicles. And there's a better description of that in Chapter 3 of the report as well. There were six issue papers as part of this study. The biggest issues this time around were finance-related issues addressed in Issue Paper 4. Some of the particular issues there were toll financing, public-private partnerships, debt financing and bond repayment, and congestion pricing. The treatment of replacement bridges was an important issue, and it's addressed in Issue Paper 1. The question there is, when a bridge is replaced with a bridge that isn't identical, how should that be treated in the cost allocation study? And then we also, for the first time, took a look at carbon taxes and cap and trade in Issue Paper 6. The issue papers are not a part of the report you received today, but they will be. They'll be available to you soon with the full set of appendices. So the results of this study...
Mr. Pitofsky, do you know if those are required to be published on paper or if they can be made available on the Internet?
Mr. Chair, I don't... maybe Mazen can help here. I don't believe there's anything in the statutes that says it has to be printed on paper.
Right. It occurs to me that these sound like they're fairly voluminous.
Yeah, I think it would be fine for electronic form.
Right, and I would suggest that perhaps the best way to distribute them would be to send the members of the two committees, maybe the whole legislature, an email with the URL containing the location of the papers and the point of sending them to us, and we may save a great deal of printing costs by doing it that way.
Okay.
Thank
you.
So.
The basic vehicles, which we define as all vehicles under 10,000 pounds in weight, traveled 35.7 billion miles, or were projected to travel 35.7 billion miles per year in the upcoming biennium. And that's 92.8% of the total vehicle miles traveled in the upcoming biennium. And 34.8 billion of those are projected to be by full fee-paying vehicles. Those basic vehicles are expected to impose $1.26 billion in annual cost responsibility, which is 64.5% of the total amount to be expended that we included in the study, and $1.23 billion of that will be by full fee-paying vehicles. They will be expected to pay $568 million in annual user fees in Oregon. They'll also be paying some federal taxes that come back in through the federal channels. And $559 million of those, of that will be by full fee-paying vehicles. They received an allocation of $16 million of the subsidy amounts, the amount by which the alternative fee-paying vehicles were charged less than they would have paid as regular vehicles. And the total costs allocated to full fee-paying basic vehicles was $1.246 billion, or 67.1% of the total costs. And basic vehicles ended up with an equity ratio of 0.9915, which is fairly close to 1.0. Heavy vehicles, which is every vehicle over 10,000 pounds, will be expected to travel 2.76 billion miles per year in the upcoming biennium. That's 7.2% of the total expected vehicle miles traveled, and 2.4 billion of those will be by full fee-paying vehicles. Their annual cost responsibility is expected to be $693 million, $611 by full fee-paying vehicles. They're expected to pay $301 million in user fees, $282 million of those by full fee-paying vehicles. They get $1.1 million of the subsidy allocated back to them. Their total allocated costs, including the subsidy for the full fee-paying vehicles, is $612 million, and they end up with an equity ratio of 1.0173. Again, very close to 1.0. Within the heavy vehicles, you have everything from 10,001 pounds up to the heaviest vehicle ever to travel on Oregon roads, which could be someone moving a house. The equity ratios for the various weight classes up to 105,500 pounds range from 0.47 to 1.55. So you can see that there is quite a variation in the equitability of the fees within heavy vehicles, much more so than between light and heavy vehicles. The study found that vehicles between 10,001 and 26,000 pounds are overpaying, that most vehicles between 26,001 and 78,000 pounds are underpaying. The one particular weight class, 78,001 to 80,000 pounds, which accounts for 43% of the heavy vehicle miles traveled, are overpaying. Their equity ratio is 1.12. And then most vehicles over 80,000 pounds are underpaying. The full details for every weight class are in Chapter 6. The recommendations of the study are that no changes are necessary for light-heavy fairness and proportionality. Chapter 7 of the report describes some revenue-neutral changes to rate structures that would improve equity within heavy vehicles. This is not part of what the Constitution requires you to look at. This is just purely for your information. If you wanted to achieve greater equity within heavy vehicles, you could have a flatter rate structure for the Table A rates. Those are the rates paid by weight mile tax vehicles between 26,001 and 80,000 pounds. We would raise the low end of that rate schedule and lower the high end of it. And then Table B rates would be raised, and the road use assessment fees, which are charged to the trucks that carry non-divisible loads at really heavy weights, would be increased. The flat fee rates, there are vehicles that, because of the commodities they carry, have the option of paying a flat monthly fee rather than paying weight mile tax per mile. And the current rates are in the top row. Rates to match the current weight mile tax are in the middle row. And then the rates to match our recommended changes to the weight mile tax are in the bottom row. And the big difference there is that for wood chips, no matter how you look at it, those would be lower to match weight mile tax. And Lorna Youngs from ODOT will be doing a fuller presentation on flat fee rates for you soon. The report you have in your hands has seven chapters: background, structural parameters, method and approach, data and forecasts, expenditure and revenue allocation results, the equity analysis and the recommendations, the appendices that will be available online and optionally on paper. We'll include the issue papers, the minutes of the study review team meetings, a user's guide for the model, model documentation, exactly how the model works, and then the detailed inputs and results from the run of the model that was the basis for the results reported here. And the model and all of these appendices are available to anyone, their public information. Issues we expect to be important in future studies are toll-financed facilities, which can get complicated if the revenue being collected is going to a private entity that that put up the costs for the construction. So it's no longer state user fees, but private user fees. New revenue instruments. There's been a variety of different ways of charging people for using roads that have been proposed. External costs, the costs that road users impose on people other than the highway system and themselves, and the treatment of non-highway investments to relieve congestion. So if things changed in the future and money raised from highway user fees could be spent on something other than more highways, but that helped the highway users by relieving congestion as new construction might, then how would we treat that in the highway cost allocation study? One future opportunity that I'd like to point out, this is something we've been trying to sell for a number of years now, is that an efficient pricing system would eliminate the need for highway cost allocation studies. If each vehicle were charged according to where and when it travels and what it actually weighs at the time that it's traveling, then the total amount collected would be automatically in proportion to the cost it's imposing, and it would also be the right amount to produce the optimal investment in highway system facilities. The and that's over time. You would need a sinking fund and bond financing to smooth out the lumpiness of highway investments. And you would also need to make the optimal investments. You would need to take a close look at the benefit-cost analysis when you're deciding how to spend the money in order to get the optimal result out of this. But it, in theory, that's how you could get exactly the right amount of money from exactly the right people. And the technology to do that is advancing rapidly. There's on-vehicle GPS that knows exactly where the vehicle is, and there are, for trucks, there are axle scales that know how much the truck weighs at that time. The onboard computers can figure out how much the vehicle should be paying at that time without having to send the private information off to the government. And it's auditable, but unless there's an audit, the private information about where you were at a particular time is not part of the information the government gets. Just what you owe for having gone wherever you did go.
All right, Representative Gilman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It really disturbs me that it's been 6 years ago when I first looked at this report, and I saw the heaviest trucks were not paying their share. That's still occurring today. And I think it's time, even though I know it's not in the preview of this committee, particularly because we're making sure that light, essentially cars, pay a proportionate share as trucks. But within trucks, there's huge inequities, and I think it's time we solve that problem. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Gilman. Other questions, comments? Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Patton, thank you for your testimony. I'm curious to touch on the last points that you made regarding potential optimization of the system by charging based on vehicle weight and time. You reference in Chapter 6 of your report potential studies on incorporating external costs. Would a system like that incorporate some internal costs, external costs, as some not, and how would that relationship exist with that system?
Chair Barnhart, Chair Beyer, and Representative Bailey, it would not be necessary to incorporate external costs in order to achieve the measure of equity that we're looking at in this study the way we do it now, or to achieve the collection of the right amount of revenue for spending on transportation infrastructure and maintenance. But if you wanted to also raise revenue to offset or mitigate those external costs, then it certainly could be incorporated into the same set of charges.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank
you. We appreciate the report, and it looks like you've given us material for many nights of study. I'm particularly interested in looking at those papers that aren't yet available, but will be soon, because they contain a lot of, I think they'll contain a lot of very useful information for us beyond simply this business of the allocation of the costs.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
And Chair Barnhart and Chair Beyer, I also want to reiterate your earlier comments, Representative Barnhart, of thanking the study review team for their time and their expertise in making the study better.
We appreciate it. It's very, very important as we work on our tax system that the public believe that we do it in a way that's fair. And this kind of a study is very helpful in that process. Patrick?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I believe Mazin is going to transition us into the flat fee study next.
Flat-footed, Mr. Chair.
Flat fee.
Chair Beyer, Chair Barnhart, the law also requires every 2 years that ODOT studies the flat fee, and now you're receiving the report. I believe you received a copy of it earlier, about a few days or a week ago. Lorna Youngs from the Department of Transportation, Deputy Director for Finance, will be presenting that study finding for you.
Thank you, Mazin. Chair Beyer, Chair Barnhart, I'm Lorna Youngs, Deputy Director for Central Services with the Oregon Department of Transportation. And you're being handed a dauntingly titled study called Testing for Revenue Neutrality of Flat Fee Firms in Oregon, affectionately known as the Flat Fee Study. As you are probably aware, we do allow under the law for firms to pay an alternative to the weight mile tax, which is a flat monthly fee. They declare a weight and they pay a monthly fee regardless of how many miles they travel. And that allows for, it was primarily set up for small firms, that the bookkeeping for a weight mile tax, determining their mileage every day and determining their tax every day was difficult, and so they can elect a flat fee approach. statute requires that every 2 years we study whether or not the fees that we are charging for flat fees are equivalent to the fee that they would pay should they use a weight mile tax approach. And so we have hired Dr. Catherine Lawson to conduct this study. She's a national expert in this arena. And what I have for you are the results. As Mr. Batten pointed out in his earlier slide, we have a disparity in those fees. Flat fees for wood chip carriers are currently at $24.62 per 100 pounds of declared weight, and for revenue neutrality, that fee should be at $13.53. The flat fee rate for sand and gravel carriers is currently $6.05 per 100 pounds, and it should be increased to $7.90 because they are underpaying. The log carriers are similarly underpaying. They're currently at $6.10 and should be paying $6.31. And these, of course, are in terms of the next biennium projected fees using the same methodology as was in the cost allocation study. And so we are recommending that should there be interest in changing fees for any other reasons, that these fees be adjusted accordingly in order to achieve revenue neutrality. And I would be happy to take any questions.
Representative Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm curious about the volatility in the flat fee rate for wood chip carriers. Why the substantial decrease?
Chairs, Representative Edwards, this is not a whole lot different than we've seen in the past. There are only two companies that are using this rate. And for when we have presented these results in the past, evidently there has not been sufficient additional more. We're talking about $65,000 approximately in additional costs. So in the scheme of things, that hasn't been adjusted when weight mile tax and flat fees have adjusted in the past. It would be my estimation.
Thank you. So presumably the volatility is due to the fact that there's such a low volume that to which this fee applies that there's volatility, substantial volatility in the results based on whatever you predict is the current activity?
Chair Beyer, Representative Barnhart, Representative Edwards, it isn't volatile. It's been this fee steadily. It's just that there are very few individuals taking advantage of it.
Mm-hmm.
It needs adjustment, clearly, but it's not affecting a large population.
Understood.
Thank you. Other? Yes.
Thank you.
Yes.
Just so I get this
straight here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's not X amount for every 100 pounds carried. It's X amount of capacity, every 100 pounds of capacity carrying weight, correct?
Yes, Chair. It's Representative Schaffler's declared weight.
Thank you. I'm a newbie.
It was not within the purview of the report to ask the policy question of whether we should maintain this special taxing capacity, was it?
Chair Barnhart, no, it was not within the purview of the statute to determine whether or not we should continue with flat fees, only to report on whether or not they achieve revenue neutrality.
Okay, and that's not a constitutionally required, and this may be a question for Mazin. It's not a constitutionally required statute, I suspect. And at the risk of causing a firestorm in a small group of people, I will wonder out loud whether or not, with the advent of modern computing, if we need something like this anymore. There may be some very good reasons to do it that I don't know about.
Chair Barnhart, there is no constitutional requirement for flat fee per se. However, if you look at the big picture of heavy versus light and where that balance stays in, these flat fees are supposedly in lieu of weight mile.
Right.
So they are, although they're an alternative, they need to be paying something of the same of it would have been paying otherwise paid weight mile. Well, that was a big sentence.
A heavy sentence.
Yeah. So in that sense, if there is an opportunity to change rates at all at any time, perhaps changing those rates will not be a bad idea. But of course, as you were saying, because of the technology, computers, and so on, not as many firms are taking advantage of the flat rates as they used to. And therefore, perhaps time would make them think of the past before we choose to do it in statutes.
Thank you very much. Yes, Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You mentioned that there were only two wood chip carriers that use this. How many carriers total use this flat fee?
Representative Riley, I don't have that number, but I'd be happy to provide it for you.
Thank you.
I think that's an excellent question if we look at this kind of report. Chair Beyer.
And you talk about the two companies that aren't that are doing this now. It sounds to me like the number has been diminishing. Has that been happening since we have not adjusted this rate? Is that a cause of the number of companies that are not availing themselves to this option?
Chair Barnhart, Chair Beyer, I don't know the answer to that, why companies are in this particular. But one of the things I do know is that there simply are not a lot of wood chips being hauled. There's very few trucks in that particular segment of the industry, period. And so it may simply be that, but I would only speculate, and perhaps Mr. Russell, who's in the room, would have a better cue as to why that is the case, but I know the industry itself is not large.
Would you like to come forward to answer that question?
I got a pretty good idea, but...
Mr. Chair, before Bob sits down, there ain't many logs or much gravel being transported in this state.
Right.
Here
we go.
That may be the answer to the question.
Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, members of the committees, Bob Russell with the Oregon Trucking Associations. When it comes to the chip, folks, well, maybe I should go back. Unfortunately, I'm one of those old guys that's been around for a long time. We put the requirement in statute that we actually do the flat fee study back in the early 90s, as I recall. And quite frankly, the idea was, because it's an option, the only people that would take advantage of it are the ones that would be benefiting financially. And then ultimately, we would keep adjusting those rates until there weren't any more. In a lot of sense, that's happened. If you look at the wood chips, I mean, that's gone. You got two companies left. There's two guys in John Day, Oregon, that refuse to go to the mileage rate. They want their flat fees. Now, if you adjusted those flat fees, as this report suggests, you're going to have a flood of wood chip folks back in. And quite frankly, that would be a reversal of where we've sort of been headed for some time. So I'm not sure that you want to reduce the wood chips.
Okay.
As far as the logs in the sand and gravel, you're pretty close, quite frankly. Again, the constitutional requirement is that you balance between light and heavy. We're there. Matter of fact, heavy's overpaying by about $5 million, which is within the margin of error. Some of these other rates that we look at the extremes, you have to remember that 85% of the truck miles of travel are at 80,000 pounds. So when you get out to the other weights, your populations are really, really small. So I don't believe that the model that we use is precise enough to deal really accurately with those small populations that are out on the extremes. That curve that we see to the weight mile tax rates has been the same, for as long as I can remember, since the mid-80s at least. And quite frankly, in the old days, the concern used to be, because 85% of the miles are at 80,000 pounds, we didn't want to miss that rate low, because that would have a huge impact on revenues. So that's, you know, that bell curve that you've got is sort of resulting from that way back when, and it's just stayed consistent. And what we generally do is we make adjustments to the rates when we do a transportation funding package, and it all sort of comes out, and then we go on from there. So
you're expecting that to happen again this year?
Mr. Chair, I am absolutely expecting that we're going to have a transportation funding package and the weight mile tax rates will change.
Thank you. I knew you wanted to get that in. Are there other questions for this panel? Thank you very much. We appreciate it. Patrick?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Madam Chair, we will move on to our third and final selection for the day, which is a brief report on the transportation revenue forecast. I think Mazin is going to lead our transition once again on that.
Yes, Chair Beyer, Chair Barnhart, I think Lorna will stay in here, and then you have Dave Kavanaugh, the state transportation economist, and I believe also that you you have Doug Tindall, the deputy director, is here to answer your questions, just in case if you have other questions that I'm sure comes up with transportation discussions. So I will leave and give them the table.
Right here.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair Beyer, Chairman Barnhart, members of the House Revenue Committee and the House Transportation Committee. For the record, I'm Dave Kavanaugh, state transportation economist. As a bit of a backdrop as to why I'm here this afternoon, ordinarily the department submits to DAS and other funds revenue forecasts twice a year. Those normally get published December 1st and June 1st of every year. This last fall, when we submitted the forecast for the December 1st publication, it was based on the department's most recent revenue forecast, which, with a little bit of understandable lags, was June of 2008. And you can all appreciate the turbulence that the economy went through during the fall. Everyone was justifiably concerned that maybe the tables were changing so much as far as the economic backdrop goes that maybe we should have an update to see what the impact is on the state transportation fund revenue forecast. So, starting that in December, we went ahead and offered that if either of the committees was interested in getting an update, we'd be more than willing and happy to, at your leisure, to go ahead and give a presentation on that. So that's kind of the backdrop of why I'm here today. So the forecast is related to taxes and fees that are collected strictly within Oregon, the other funds transportation forecast. That amounts on a biennium basis on the order of about $1.8 to $2 billion in gross revenues per biennium. The forecast for other funds doesn't include, importantly enough, federal funds that we get from the Federal Highway Trust Fund and the apportionments out of that trust fund. The report is actually very aggregated in terms of just reporting gross numbers. And so to get a little bit better sense of the resources that are actually available to the agency in implementing its maintenance programs, preservation programs, bridge programs, it's probably good to recognize that net revenues are all that we have to work with. Once we account for collection costs, program transfers, and general and administrative costs, we only wind up with about $1.5 billion per biennium in the net, okay? That's on slide one. And then, according to statute, we also apportion the net revenues among the State Highway Fund and the city governments and the county governments. The counties get roughly about $340 million a biennium in their apportionments. There are four or five different apportionment formulas that are applied to different types of revenues that are being brought in. And then the cities get about $230
million per biennium in the apportionment. So all told, the highway fund is split about $570 million to the local governments, and a little over $900 million remains for the state highway fund, to kind of put things in perspective. So you can see there's a fair amount of dilution that occurs from our gross revenue and collections that we report in the other fund's forecast to what we actually have to work with. How do we forecast the revenues? We use a model very similar in approach to what is used to derive the state economic forecast. Moreover, when we do a forecast, we link it intricately with the state economic forecast. That is, we use the same employment numbers, total non-farm, and also selected industries. We use the same personal income numbers to go ahead and drive our forecast, saying that these economic and demographic trends in the state are going to partially drive ODOT's revenue picture. We also link to concurrently the same macro backdrop that is used to solve the state economic model. So right now our December 2008 forecast is linked to the Office of Economic Analysis state economic forecast circa December 2008. Now we all know that a week from Friday that's going to change and be updated a little bit, so we'll be out of sync again, which is part of the dilemma that we had last fall and necessitated me coming back. The balance of the presentation, I'll give an overview of the revenue forecast, and then give an illustration of how well the model is tracking to hopefully give you a little bit of comfort that we have a pretty good handle on what we think is going on to revenues, and by virtue of that we have a good handle on the future years in the forecast, and then just some summary changes in the outlook. And, of course, any forecast wouldn't be complete without a little bit of wiggle room in terms of caveats, talking about forecast risks and uncertainties that are attendant with that. What does the composition of the revenues look like? In the past, we've found that it's good to identify revenue by sources. In the other funds revenue forecast, we aggregate all the transactions into five main categories. There's the motor fuel taxes, which are taxes that are from gas tax and diesel fuel tax, the diesel fuel being paid by light vehicles, but also commercial vehicles under 26,000 pounds. Heavy trucks in excess of 26,000 pounds, as you know, and as also was alluded to in the highway cost allocation study earlier, pay a weight mile tax. They don't pay a diesel fuel tax. The motor fuels component is about 47% of the gross revenues. The weight mile tax, which is the tax paid by trucks in excess of 26,000 pounds, is about 25%. The other sources of revenue are the vehicle license fees, which basically are the many and varied vehicles that are registered, all the way from mopeds and motorcycles to cars, trailers, if you will, and also heavy trucks. Driver's license fees, that's non-commercial drivers as well as commercial drivers are in that category. And then the final component are the other transportation license fees. Those are largely titles that are related to ownership vehicles, title transfers, duplicate titles. And it also includes the revenue that's developed by ODOT in doing regulation activities, for example, regulating new car dealers. There are fees that are retrieved from those activities. The components of the forecast, I'm sorry, I wanted to go back. I had another component to the chart on figure one, on slide three, revenue by type. What this does is take the same amount of money, but it groups by the revenues that vary by how intensely the system is actually used. Those are use taxes. Those are gas taxes and the weight mile tax. The other component are basically fixed fee taxes that don't vary by how intensively you use the system. So you can see that we're largely a use tax oriented system. So the more people use the system, the more that they're going to pay for it, which has an appeal of equity to kind of the fee and the tax structure. Moving ahead now to the slide four on the gas and diesel tax revenues. Last year was not a real good year for fuel tax revenues. It was down about 3.5% from 2007. The silver lining in that is that even though other states had a bigger drop, ours wasn't quite as pronounced, largely, I suspect, because of House Bill 2210, which was that had the ethanol blending feature in it. But ethanol in gasoline produces a little bit poorer gas mileage. I don't know if any of you have experienced or tried to measure that yourselves, but I have, because I have to forecast it. But it looks like maybe that blending bill actually had the impact of causing our gasoline sales not to be as low as they would have otherwise. And so it kind of pumped it up a little bit.
But, Mr. Chair, but we're saving the world.
Chair Beyer and Chair Barnhart, Chair Schauffer,
I think that was...
Was that a rhetorical... Thank you very much. let's see. What was I going to say else in the context of the HB 2210? But the long and the short of it is, it looks like for last year, which the bill was phased in three stages in 2008, so we won't have kind of a full annual run rate until 2009 going forward. But it does look like it's probably propped up revenues on the instead of being off by about 4.5% or 5%, it's only off by about 3.5%. Our current December 2008 forecast, now this is on a fiscal year basis. That 3.5% was a calendar year comparison. And so it's pretty easy to get confused here what the benchmark is. But now we're forecasting on a fiscal year basis. The blue line on the chart shows what our current forecast is, shows a fairly pronounced dip going into fiscal year 2009. It rebounds in going into fiscal year 2010, and then and grows slowly as the economy recovers and we start going along the kind of the balanced growth path, if you will, thereafter. In contrast with the prior forecast, the little dashed line was our sanguine view of the world in December of 2007. Now, the 2007 forecast is kind of what is the basis of the agency's requested budget in terms of preliminary budget calculus, if you will. So we had a very optimistic view of the world, but then again, the macro backdrop and the state economic forecast was much more sanguine as well. So that's part of the pitfalls of forecasting, is that things are always changing. By June of 2008, the green line, we started to sense that things weren't quite as up to snuff with the economy as we thought in December of 2007. Things stayed a little bit flat, but then we didn't really have a full blown economic contraction in our macro backdrop like we do now. So that explains the severe dips. A couple of interesting questions is we've had a real drop-off in gasoline prices since last summer's peak. People might think that that's going to be a savior in terms of our gas tax revenue picture. Gee, gas is down to around $2 or less per gallon. Aren't people going to go ahead and drive more? Well, the answer to that is probably not that much more. Gasoline, as I think I've mentioned before, some of these selected committees in the past, is what's called a derived demand. People don't consume gasoline directly for the utility or satisfaction it provides. They consume gasoline because it helps them carry out their daily activities of doing such a joyous things as going to work, going to school, and pursuing their leisure and hospitality activities. It's those activities that they need the gasoline for, and so that drives the demand for it. Because of that, derived demand functions aren't real sensitive to price, and so we expect a little bit of an impact of lower gasoline prices, but in and of itself, not all that great of a one. Where we really get the big bang for our buck in the drop-off in gasoline prices is that for every dollar drop in gasoline nationwide, that improves households' budgets by about $250 to $280 billion a year if that dollar drop was enforced for the full year. So that's a considerable economic stimulus by itself. We're down $2 from last summer, so right now we're looking at maybe close to $500 billion in stimulus that wouldn't be there if gasoline prices hadn't dropped. What do people do in response to that? They start doing more discretionary things. They start doing more meals out. How do they do that? They have to drive. And that drive demand is what goes ahead and starts propping up gasoline consumption. The other component of use tax are the weight mile taxes paid by heavy trucks. Last year, in calendar year 2008, they were off quite a bit. They were off by about 6.1%. And this includes not only the direct weight mile taxes, but also other mileage and trip-related fees that are in lieu of having to pay a weight mile tax, and also the road user assessment fee. The forecast, again, in terms of fiscal years, is in the chart. The solid blue line, again, is our best take now with the current state economic forecast and macro backdrop as to where we're going. You can see that weight mile taxes were recovered, were pretty flat in 2006 and 2007, but they're and a little bit off in 2008. Again, the comparison between fiscal year and calendar year gets a little bit trickier because we're at the kind of a turning point or inflection point in the economy. But in 2009, they drop off quite a bit. There's quite a trough, but then they start to rebound thereafter once, again, the economy starts to kick in and fire on all cylinders, hopefully after the federal stimulus package gets through and things start to get implemented. The prior forecast, again, the December 2007 forecast is the dashed line. You can see that we're way underneath that as well as underneath a little bit what we were forecasting or projecting in June of 2008. The trucking industry is suffering quite a few layoffs. There's unemployment is rising in that sector because, again, the demand for freight shipment is way down. Bankruptcies by firms are starting to become more prominent. Short-haul carriers are being affected about equally with long-haul in that scheme. Sometimes if it's long-haul, there's maybe more competition, for example, with railroads. But in this case, it seems to be pretty uniform across all distances. The final major component of the forecast are the fixed fee forecasts, which are the vehicle and driver-related fees all combined. These include DMV collections as well as commercial vehicle registrations of heavy trucks as well. Okay, these are all the fixed fee payments. Historically, the revenues in calendar year 2008 were off by about 5.8% from the prior year, also a fairly large drop. We normally don't get quite as much sensitivity like we do with motor fuel taxes and weight mile taxes in a downturn, but what's happening here, and I'll illustrate a little bit later, is that indeed DMV revenues are becoming a little bit more sensitive than we ordinarily would expect because of the drop in new car sales. With people not going into the showrooms, the big three automakers, as you've seen in the headlines, their year-over-year sales are off 40-45%. And so that means that we get fewer revenues from new vehicle registrations, which are billed at four-year durations. And also we get reduced new title revenues by the fact that there aren't that many new cars being sold. So it really starts to affect DMV revenues, makes DMV fee revenues a little bit more volatile because just the nature of this downturn being led by a real crash in consumer durable spending in the form of automobiles.
We have a question.
Representative Schaffer?
Yes.
Thank you. I wish you got a pretty narrow window of time there, and I wish you would have went back like 30 years, give me some perspective on these trends. But knowing what I know now, and I'm not an economist, and I'm not going to question any of your data or your conclusions, but you said the dashed line, that you had was rather optimistic. I think that's an understatement. I knowing what I know now, I just think those lines should be flatter. And I think I hope you're right and I'm wrong, but I think they're optimistic the way you got them right there.
Madam Chair Beyer, Chair Barnhart, Representative Schlaufer. Well, generally, the vehicle and driver fees are tied to demographics. which don't grow at an anywhere near rate as employment or personal income. So it's a little bit more stable. It's kind of the flip side of the volatility that I was describing earlier. Unless if Oregon's population kind of levels off and starts to decline, we expect demographic-driven revenue sources to actually continue to grow. And you're right, a more historical representation of the data would be revealing, but it would show a gradual revenue growth. It just doesn't grow as fast because it is being driven by population growth, by and large. And we haven't had a decline in population since 1981, 1982, during that recession. Ever since then, net migration has been positive, plus our natural population growth has been positive.
Then maybe I missed something, because if it's strictly driven by demographics, and maybe you've already explained this and I missed it, and maybe I just need to talk to you offline, but that sudden downturn doesn't reflect our demographics currently, even within that window.
Madam Chair Beyer, Chair Barnard, no, you're right. And this, the demographics affect more the light vehicle division of drivers and vehicles revenues. This combines commercial vehicles as well. So in that respect, it's probably a little bit more sensitive just to the overall downturn. If I showed you just light vehicle titles and registrations and non-commercial driver's licenses, it wouldn't show anywhere near quite this kind of a dip. But then there is a little bit of sleight of hand here as to how we actually go ahead and scale the units of these charts. And what we've done here is to go ahead to at least make some talking points. We had the scale where it shows a fair amount of sensitivity. If indeed I had gone ahead and displayed 30 years, which worth of history, then the scale would have had to be in from like $50 million up to $300 million, and things would have looked much more linear with hardly any ups and downs. So there's a little bit of discretion there as to how you kind of represent the units or the scale. Here, it probably has a tendency to kind of make it more pronounced than it really is.
Thank you. You're showing a detail of a much larger graph.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Representative Beyer.
Would you also include some policy decisions that the legislature made in that reduction on your chart?
Madam Chair Beyer, I'm not sure which ones you have in mind.
Say the Oregon driver's license.
Madam Chair, yes. That is in the forecast. That was Senate Bill 1080. Yes, we have that legislation in the forecast, and it's an overall base or context here. All these revenue forecasts are based on current law. They don't make an attempt to go ahead and predict what's going to happen, for example, with HB 2120 before the current session. We would go ahead, if legislation like that got passed, then we would put that into our June 2009 forecast. So it's all current law, but we do have that, if you will, baked into the driver's license revenue forecast portion of the model.
May I also add... Chair Beyer, that if you take a look at that earlier chart on page 3, you see that the driver license fees are a fairly small source of revenue, $75 million compared to the vehicle license fees and the other fees. So this whole category here, the downturn is being driven primarily by lower registration revenues and lower title revenues, some effect of the change in the requirements for driver licensing, but certainly the magnitude of the change is being driven more on the vehicle side.
So a piece of it then is the reduction in the sale of new vehicles?
That's an illustration of why it has gone down. That's a major component, new vehicle titles and new vehicle registrations, because, again, when you buy a new vehicle, you're paying for 4 years rent instead of the two on a normal renewal cycle. Okay, I think we've pretty well covered the new car sales part of the impact, so I'm pretty much done with figure four. An idea of how well we're tracking. the revenues is illustrated with the fuel tax forecast. What we have in the blue dotted line or dashed line is the December 2007 forecast. That basically starts its forecasting mode, if you will, in November of 2007 with the inherent data lags. And you can see that the forecast going forward from November 2007 seemed to track the overall pattern, but it systematically overpredicted what actually happened, which is the solid black line with the little black triangles. Well, by last summer, June of 2008, we updated the model, and it also shares the same pattern, but it's not the gaps aren't quite as bad with actual, so we're starting to get the model back on track, but it's still off systematically, and that's not a good thing. We'd like the errors to be kind of offsetting. So the model was systematically over-predicting, but considerably less than it was in December 2007. Of course, the economic backdrop had started to really deteriorate and change quite a bit, and that's why we were getting a little bit better. Our current forecast is the golden line, and it basically has the benefit of kind of calibrating to our experience during the fall and going into the winter months, and so it's kind of tracking very closely with actuals, and hopefully that means that initially going forward we'll continue to track pretty well. If the economy doesn't get too much worse, then probably going forward our revenue forecast for motor fuels will start to come back into line and be a little bit better. In summary, the economic downturn is definitely having a major impact on our usage-related taxes, okay, which is the gas tax, diesel tax, and weight mile taxes. But also, as I've tried to highlight a little bit, there's been more sensitivity to our fixed fee revenues in this particular downturn. Overall, going forward, we're now projecting from 2009 on a fiscal year basis, revenues growing at an average rate of about 2.5% under current law. 2.5%, that's a little bit less than probably the rate of construction cost employment, so the overall purchasing power of the highway fund is still continuing to lose ground. That's a theme that I've continually identified in prior presentations to the committees. And as you can see, the gap this time around stays pretty wide between what we forecast, which is the dashed green line in June of 2008. A little bit more detail of what that comprises, that rising gap, is given on in Figure 6 on the next slide. You can see that basically there's a big change from what we presented last time in November, where the revenue erosion, if you will, occurred in the FY09, FY10, and then it diminished and kind of disappeared by the time we got out to the end of the forecast horizon. Now, it's still fairly sizable. In FY09, it's on the order of $32 million lower than what we were forecasting 6 months ago. But the gap continues to stay wide throughout the forecast horizon. Basically, we have a little bit lower personal income growth. We have a slightly lower population growth. All these things combined, even though we rally out of this contraction and have a recovery, we never really get back up to the same revenue levels as what we were forecasting about 6 months ago. All told, spread combined over all the years in the forecast, it's about a $300 million shortfall in collected revenues on a gross basis than what we were forecasting in June, out of total collections of about $6 billion from that period. It's about $5.7 or $5.8 billion. So that kind of gives you a sense of where we were. The prior forecast in June, it too was a little bit lower than December's, and on the order of about 150. So now when we go ahead and see where we are today from where we were forecasting in June of 07, we're about $450 million short on that. Okay, the wiggle room that I was talking about, concerns in the outlook. There's the recession goblin that everyone's worried about. Hopefully, the current quarter that we're in will be the trough of the recession, but there's no guarantee that's going to be the case. Fourth quarter wasn't quite as bad as people thought it was going to be in terms of the GDP numbers, but more than likely those are going to be revised downward a little bit to get it closer to what people were expecting. It was minus 3.8% at an annual rate for the fourth quarter on a preliminary basis, or actually it's called advanced. It'll probably be closer to 5 to 5.5% when they go ahead and refine the numbers. This quarter should probably be about the same, and then once things start to kick in, people are a little bit happier about spring arriving and whatnot. Maybe that'll put a spring in their step, and the economy will start to get back on track. There's always the global economic volatility and the financial market volatility. A lot of problems still remain there to get those solved, so anything can happen there. Attendant with the macro backdrop, we also do a construction cost trends and outlook forecast that uses the same macro forecast, and that has some global economic elements that are fed into it. It looks now that we're past the peak of the spike in commodity prices in 2007 and early 2008, and going forward, hopefully just for materials only, okay, not fuel, not labor, it looks like it's going to be running at an annual rate of about 2 to 3% for that portion of a construction budget. And then finally, construction labor costs will probably be a little bit elevated, but still somewhat muted from what they were the year before. So with that, that's my my overview, and I'd be happy to answer any more questions.
Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Madam Chair, I just want to make sure that I'm understanding correctly on your slide entitled Forecast Summary in the gap between the June 08 forecast and December 08 forecast. Are you saying that even if we have a recovery in the spring here, we're likely to see a persistent gap in the expected growth of revenue from these sources?
Madam Chair Beyer, Chair Barnhart, Representative Bailey, it's a matter of the economic outlook in June being what it was and now being a little bit lower, and we kind of lose flows and business activities, if you will, but the growth rates actually are fairly comparable. I think last summer the growth rate was about 2.8%. Now we're forecasting about 2.5%. Well, it's all a function of kind of the base of where you calculate that growth rate from. So the growth, in answer to your question, is roughly about the same. It's just that the revenue levels aren't quite on par with what we had. Now, if personal incomes aren't quite as high as what you thought they were going to be in June of 2008, then discretionary household purchasing power is a little bit less, so people are doing fewer things. So the overall level of business activity is going to be at a lower annual rate. So, the growth rate, growth rates are reasonably indistinguishable.
Okay, thank you.
Go ahead. Representative Edwards.
Thank you,
this out.
Mr. and Madam Chair.
we'll figure it out, too. he was on my list, and I was worried.
Okay.
As you know, the governor has proposed a jobs and transportation package that includes an increase in the gas tax. The conventional wisdom is that for every 1 cent of increase, we see about $29 million. Based on the trends that you outlined as part of your presentation, what do you think the current estimate should be for every 1 cent increase?
Madam Chair Beyer, Chair Barnhart, Representative Edwards, yes, we produced that in our summary report as kind of a memo item. It's probably going to be $28 million in change, not too much different. That rule of thumb of $29 million per penny per gallon tax is probably still going to be a useful rule of thumb. I think the report will show that it's going to be, again, $28 million and change, so it won't be that much different.
Right,
yeah, so that'll be fairly reliable rule of thumb.
Representative Schaffler.
Thank you. And the $300 million shortage over the next 6 years, that's with the system we have now and just maintaining what we have now, that's not widening, improving, fixing, upgrading, any of that.
Madam Chair Beyer, Chair Barnhart, Representative Schaffer, Doug is getting real nervous here about these types of questions, so I think I'll let him answer that for you.
Thanks. Chair Beyer, Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, Doug Tindall, Deputy Director of Oregon Department of Transportation. Chairs Byron Barnhart, Representative Schaffler, this is just purely a revenue forecast. So this doesn't talk about the expenditure side at all. This just simply says that compared to the June 2008 forecast, there's $300 million less dollars than there were. That's $300 million less dollars to work from than we had anticipated back in June. But it doesn't really anticipate the expenditure side.
So you overlay the needed expenditures, and it's far worse than that. Am I correct?
Chairs Byron Barnhart, Representative Schaffler, yes, we started with a deficit, if you look at compared our expenditures to needs, and so this just adds to it.
Right, thank you.
Right, we're underwater, and before, we're more underwater now.
Right, thank you.
Yeah. As a reference, and not in any way belittling this particular problem, I think the state economist would love to have this problem as compared to the problem he's actually got with the income tax, which is, of course, off quite a bit more as a percentage of the total. But we cannot underestimate the problem that we have in the transportation sector with the reality that we are eating our capital every year. We aren't replacing enough, maintaining enough, in order to keep our system at the same level of readiness and availability that we had the year before. And that's a fair statement, isn't it?
Chair Barnhart, it's absolutely a fair statement. I think that and I agree that there's a huge challenge for the state and the legislature faces outside of transportation. I think you've characterized it correctly in that you have a problem as you look at the 09-11 biennium with revenues, and the problem with underinvestment in transportation is that plays out over decades.
Yeah.
And the losses caused by not taking care of a system and the cost of having to go in and rebuild the system are far higher than maintenance.
Thank you. Others?
I, for one, very much appreciate the presentation of this very thoughtful report and forecast, and the work that the transportation administrator and the Legislative Revenue Office have done to help pull all these pieces together for us today. I want to say that I appreciate the transportation committee allowing us to horn in on their time. For their regular committee today, and if we're finished, anybody, anything else? If we're finished, the House Revenue Committee will adjourn until tomorrow.
And I also want to thank you for coming, and thank you for the presentations, as upbeat as they are. And thank the Revenue Committee for joining us. I think we did a nice favor to the five members of my committee that also sit on yours, that they don't have to sit through this twice. So with that, I'm going to go ahead and adjourn.
Oh, Madam Chair, for
yes.
you. I'm just glad we didn't have to sit through the income tax forecast.
Yes. I will agree with you. We are adjourned.